This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations. SHRM.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economic story of this Tuesday actually began late yesterday. Lehman Brothers offered $3 billion in new stock. Gutsy move in a market that can't quite figure itself out. But all that $3 billion was snapped up, plus a billion more. So first thing this morning, Wall Street was off to the races. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org/value. And by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is April 1st today, Tuesday. Good to have you with us. There was no fooling around on Wall Street today, even after traders learned a $19 billion write-down from the Swiss investment bank UBS was for real. Part of that announcement, though, was that UBS is going to do what Lehman did, go to the markets and raise new capital, lots of it. Whether that's real or imagined confidence, all three major indices spiked more than 3% today. The logic goes something like this. The more we know about subprime-related write-downs, the less bad news there is left to come. The guy orchestrating the economy goes to Capitol Hill tomorrow. Ben Bernanke is due to make an appearance before the Joint Economic Committee. Today, it was executives from Big Oil in the hot seat. They were trying to defend billions of dollars worth of tax breaks. Tough at any time. Much harder when prices, not to mention industry profits, are near record highs. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more.
Profits aside, it probably wasn't fun to be an oil executive today. Democratic Congressman John Larson wanted to know what taxpayers are getting for their investment in oil companies. $18 billion in tax breaks over 10 years.
If I was one of your shareholders, I'd say, you know, they're not doing a bad job. I'm getting a pretty good yield on my dollar here. But if I'm a citizen of this country, I'm saying, we're not making out so well here.
The industry argued that taking away the tax breaks would be unfair and that it actually pays more taxes than other industries. But really, if you're making $123 billion, why do you care about $1.8 billion in tax breaks a year?
Even if you're a billionaire, you care about the last dollar that you just made.
Tyson Slocum directs the energy program at Public Citizen.
$1.8 billion, sure, in a $3 trillion federal budget, it might be a small thing, but it would have real impact if it was invested wisely.
The tax breaks amount to $6 per person in the country. Slocum says imagine if that money were used to install solar panels nationwide. But Jerry Taylor at the Cato Institute points out that most of the tax breaks at issue are not oil and gas specific. They're given out across the manufacturing sector to encourage doing business domestically.
I think there's a pretty good case for getting rid of that credit for everybody. But singling out the oil and gas companies simply distorts markets even further and probably doesn't lead to more efficient economic activity.
President Bush has threatened to veto any bill getting rid of the tax breaks, saying it would only make gas prices higher. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
All the money streaming into the stock market today had to come from someplace, and commodities were part of it. Gold fell to almost $870. It was over 1,000 a week ago. Oil was down as well, but some commodities have been going the other way. Rising grain prices led to riots in Egyptian breadlines a month or so ago. Rice has doubled in the past couple of months. Yesterday, workers at a Nike factory in Vietnam, where rice is a staple, went on strike for better pay to offset higher consumer prices. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler considers supply and demand.
As India and China grow and grow more wealthy, demand for rice is rising. At the same time, supplies have been hurt by a drought in Australia, floods in Bangladesh, and a plant virus in Vietnam. Nicholas Minot is a senior fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute.
Small shifts in a country importing when they normally export or exporting less than they normally do can have an inordinate effect on the world market price.
Currency exchange rates have an impact, too. So says agricultural economics professor Bruce Babcock at Iowa State University.
You're also seeing a lot of prices being set in U.S. dollars. And so just like oil prices have gone up because of the fall in U.S. dollar, so too have the prices of food commodities.
Rice producers like India, Cambodia, and Vietnam have put restrictions on exports. Some farmers in the region are already hoarding rice supplies, waiting for prices to rise even higher. But Nicholas Minot sees a silver lining in that kind of speculation.
It's actually not such a bad thing. It's saving rice for later months when you expect the shortage to be even worse.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture forecasts that this year, global rice stockpiles will fall to their lowest levels in 25 years. That could spell big profits for growers in Thailand, the world's largest exporter of rice. Thai rice currently sells for about $760 per metric ton. The Thai commerce minister predicts rice will hit $1,000 a ton. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
There's a special circle of air travel purgatory this week. It's Terminal 5 at London's Heathrow Airport. Since T5 opened last Thursday, more than 250 flights have been canceled. Dozens more were scrubbed today. And there is a backlog of 19,000 suitcases that have been parted from their passengers. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio on why it is so hard to get your luggage from here to there.
Automated baggage handling systems are designed to shuttle millions of bags to airports round the clock. So how come they're so delicate?
It's not rocket science, but what it really has been turned into is something where you got way too many computers, way too many moving parts, and the result is it's a meltdown.
Consultant Mike Boyd says Heathrow's Terminal 5 needs to simplify its design. But it helps to remember the scale here. T5 is the largest single terminal in one of the busiest international airports in the world. Everett Mayer with Jacobs Consultancy says the system is working as designed. Mayer blames industrial sabotage for the backlog.
There have been rumors even of, skis being inserted into the system. And what we're hearing also is that the new workers weren't adequately trained. They weren't told where to park.
But it's hard to blame such an enormous breakdown, $49 million in disruption costs for British Airways, on labor alone. John Hansman directs MIT's International Center for Air Transportation. He says automated baggage systems use a relatively old technology, barcode scanning, and they're ripe for redesign.
There are people looking at alternative technologies, things like radio frequency ID chip.
But any new system would have to be global. So if one airport's upgraded, they'd all have to follow. That may be difficult, but it probably sounds good to the thousands of people stranded at Heathrow's Terminal 5. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Traders got the second quarter of calendar 08 off to a roaring start today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Judging by Wall Street today, you'd think the whole Bear Stearns episode never happened. Traders bought like they didn't have a care in the world. The truth is that there are still huge chunks of the financial system that aren't healthy yet. Henry Paulson announced a plan yesterday to try to get some of that system under control. But his proposal doesn't discourage the speculation that helped create the problem. Take, for example, a once obscure kind of credit insurance that's become an enormous moneymaker for some of the country's biggest banks and other rich investors. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, is here to try to explain this for us. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Kai.
So I take it what we're about to hear is another thing that we knew nothing about, but yet somehow now we need to be really, really concerned about.
I'm afraid so. In this case, what you don't know can hurt you. I'm going to try to mention this term only once, Kai. We're talking about something called credit default swaps.
And they are.
They were invented a few years back so banks and bondholders, the investors, could make sure that they got paid back when companies failed to pay their loans. So in a way, you could call this insurance.
You could call it that, but we don't. We call them something else. How do these things work?
Well, this is where it gets tough, Kai, because a lot of people on Wall Street, even some of the leading economists in the academic world, don't really understand exactly how these things work. A lot of them are whipped up with some computer wizardry, some advanced math. Think of those fancy Greek letters turned on their sides. And there's a lot of guesswork to this, too, about how much they're really worth.
All right, so what's the problem, though, if everybody agrees that they don't know what they're worth?
Well, the critics I've spoken to complain that they're really nothing more than gaming instruments, gambling. It turns out that the big hedge funds that attract so much money from rich investors and big institutions, well, they're playing the market on their own, and they don't even need to have a stake in a particular company to do that.
I'm going to make the analogy here to a March Madness office pool, right? I go in, I pick a basketball team, and if they do great, that's great, but I'm not vested.
It is, except instead of wagering on UCLA and Auburn, these big bankers and brokers and hedge fund managers pick up the phone and they negotiate these wagers privately. Nobody really regulates this. They've created this incredibly enormous shadow financial system, if you will, that's virtually hidden from investors and analysts and regulators.
How big would incredibly enormous be?
Okay. I'm about to unload some numbers on you here, so I'll speak slowly so you can follow
this.
Thank you. The value of the entire U.S. Treasuries market, $4.5 trillion.
All right.
The value of the entire mortgage market, $7 trillion.
Okay.
The size of the U.S. stock market, $22 trillion. Okay, you ready?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
The size of the credit default swap market last year, $45 trillion.
That's a lot of money, Bob.
It is, and the great unknown here is that these things get traded or swapped between the banks and hedge funds and other investors. And there's really no one who oversees or regulates these trades to guarantee that the buyer actually is going to be able to make good on these if they have to. And these things end up being so interconnected that it's not just like a single line of dominoes falling if one fails. Imagine one falling domino taking down two more and those taking down four more and eight and so on.
Okay, I'm with you, but let me ask you this. We just had the Secretary of the Treasury yesterday with a big policy announcement. If these things are so bad, what's being done about it?
The irony here is that the former Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, a couple of years ago, he called credit default swaps probably the most important instrument in finance because they were supposed to spread risk around and stabilize the market. Well, critics now say that they've had exactly the opposite effect. One of the leading critics of these things is Christopher Whalen. He's an expert on financial risk at Institutional Risk Analytics, and he told me this is nothing more than government-guaranteed gambling.
They are the most hideous kind of speculation. To have a federally insured bank like J.P. Morgan as the largest dealer in this market, to me, says we don't know what we're doing anymore, and we don't understand the difference between real work, real economic activity, and something that's essentially wasting.
And Whalen points out that Bear Stearns had more than $2.5 trillion in credit default swaps. He suspects that's why J.P. Morgan came to the rescue, so it didn't get pulled down.
Yeah, not too big to fail, but too interconnected to fail, right?
That's right.
Marketplace's Bob Moon and our Explainer series starring Mr. Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Guy.
You might have gotten a little note from the Internal Revenue Service recently telling you about your forthcoming rebate check. It's part of the economic stimulus package Congress and the White House agreed to a couple of months ago. Most taxpayers will get anywhere from $600 to $1,200 back from Uncle Sam. The hope is that we'll spend it to buy things, which would be what the government wants to give the economy a kick in the pants. The worry is that many have said they'll pay down their debts instead. So with some taxpayers, the IRS isn't taking any chances, as Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing? You?
Gordon and Stacy Atkinson live in Phoenix, Arizona, in a home they bought with a subprime loan.
Come on in.
Like many subprimers, they're having a hard time paying the mortgage. So, eager for their $1,200 rebate check, they filed their taxes in February.
And I was expecting, or we were expecting, a rebate check shortly thereafter.
It eventually arrived. sort of.
We get this thing in the mail. It's addressed from the IRS. Had no idea what it was.
So we opened up the package and, well, actually, I can show you what was inside of it. Do you want to come see it?
Yeah, sure.
It's an air conditioner.
General Electric Zone Line air conditioner.
After they got over their shock, the Atkinsons called the IRS for an explanation. So did I.
My name is Beverly Jaworski. My title is Debt to Purchase Ratio Assessor.
Armed with a huge IRS database, Beverly and others like her have spent the last few months identifying taxpayers who'd be most likely to use their rebate checks to pay off debt.
Someone who may be listing their house on the market as a short sale, for instance, or students with student loans, or screenwriters.
Then those taxpayers get special rebates.
Instead of receiving that check that they were going to receive, we send it to them in the form of retail goods, in relative value to what their check would have been.
In other words, the government makes sure these taxpayers' rebates get spent in the manner intended by spending it for them on stuff. But how to be sure it's stuff the taxpayer actually needs?
You know, we plug in Social Security numbers into our database, we find where the people live, and we send them something that would be suitable to their lifestyle.
That's why a couple in the Arizona desert might get an air conditioner. Someone in Boston might get a snowblower. Jaworski says the program will target only about 1 million taxpayers, but that equals close to $1 billion guaranteed to be injected into the economy. Even so, critics say it's not worth the effort. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley.
It's too little, too late. Also, the government is not terribly good at knowing what individual people want, even in the same neighborhood. I mean, my neighbor might want, say, Viagra. But if the government ships a toaster oven to my neighbor and ships Viagra to me, and by the way, I don't use Viagra, that's not going to be terribly efficient. I would much rather get the toaster oven. Now, I suppose my neighbor and I could barter, but then I would have to know exactly what the government shipped my neighbors, and it would be difficult for all of us to get together and know that fact.
Reich also notes the government can send a rebate check for the price of a 41-cent postage stamp. Sending toasters or bikes could cost a lot more taxpayer money. But Beverly Jaworski says the IRS gets a discount.
Well, we own the post office, and they'll do as we say.
Meanwhile, back in Phoenix, the Atkinsons are of two minds about their air conditioner rebate.
I love it, because I get really hot sometimes. But unfortunately, she doesn't feel the same way, I don't think.
Yeah, because, I mean, we've got a ton of debt, and this thing's going to increase our utility bills.
Okay, true. We could lose the house. But until then, it'll be cool and comfortable.
In Phoenix, Arizona, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Oh, come on. Check your calendars, everybody. Coming up, when immigrants leave and businesses are left behind.
Once shops like mine won't make it through, they will realize what they lost.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was either the first sign of a long overdue spring or maybe just a case of spring fever that caused the Dow Industrials to jump 391 points today, a gain of 3.1% to finish at 12,654. The NASDAQ surged 83 points, 3.6%, wrapping up trading at 2,362. The S&P 500 chugged up 47 points, that is 3.6%, ended at 1,370. That cash infusion at Lehman Brothers that we mentioned earlier brought a new lease on life to financial stocks. Lehman shares rocketed up almost 18%. Merrill Lynch stock rose almost 13%. Citigroup climbed 11%. J.P. Morgan stock added the most to both the Dow and the S&P 500. It was up almost 9.5%. Bond prices fell. That lifted the yield on the 10-year Treasury note to 4.4%. You're listening to MarketPlace.
MarketPlace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. At Vanguard.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for February. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee discusses nuclear terrorism. And the House Committee on Homeland Security hosts a technology fair entitled Detecting and Responding to Bioterrorism. The event is open to House representatives and the public. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We took you down to Louisiana last week for a story about corruption, corruption reform in the Bayou State, actually. Dan Furrier lives in Los Altos, California now, up near San Francisco, but he says his hometown of Baton Rouge is never far from his thoughts, and neither are its politics.
All you have to do is read the newspaper to see that there are people who are being placed on hiring committees. These people have contracts with the departments that they're choosing the department head for, and it seems like a big conflict of interest to me.
We told you Friday about federal contractors and a Government Accountability Office report that says the government's using too many of them. Part of the story was that applicants for federal positions are in short supply. Winifred Baido from Houston, Texas, says we skirted the real issue there that contractors pay 27% better than the government does.
If I had the choice of working for the government at 27% less, which one would I choose?
We had our technology guy, Kevin Pereira, on last week. He and I talked about gadgets that are being marketed with women in mind. Heather Kronk of Tacoma Park, Maryland, said she, for one, wasn't thrilled with our choices.
Because a camera shakes less, I don't know that that's more appealing to a woman. I think you have to read something into it in order to make it a woman's product.
On the other hand, Anne Scanlon, she's an American technical writer living in Ireland's County Cork, wrote to say that she enjoyed all the toys we talked about, save one, an alarm clock that gets emails and news feeds called...
The Chumby. I am really conflicted about the Chumby. The little guy is cute, but the device I don't think is cute yet. It's not little enough, and it doesn't come in enough colors.
So it could conceivably be cute in the future, right? And now, I'll be honest here. I did the segment. I'm still not sure what that thing is supposed to be. I did an interview a couple of weeks ago with a guy named Dan Rome. He's got a book out about how office presentations could be improved with more napkins and less PowerPoint. Back of the Napkin, the book is called. I did a little test where I asked him to sell this program with a back of the napkin sketch, convince stations to carry it, that is. His pitch was that people who listen to financial programs have money and influence. Not so, says Boston artist Ann Scott. She has to carry two part-time jobs to get by.
As an artist, I love it when the market roars because I sell paintings when that happens, and someday may get to dump one of my part-time jobs.
If you've got comments or corrections, or if you just want to say hi, head to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. The dollar followed stocks up today. Traders bumped the greenback about 1% higher against the euro. Foreign exchange rates, of course, play into the economy in a whole bunch of ways. Imports and exports, manufacturing, and immigration, too. Not about people coming here, about people leaving. Brazilian immigrants in the United States are returning home by the thousands. With the dollar falling and the economy back home booming, many of them have decided it's simply not worth it to live here anymore. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has the story.
Eugenia Benicio just bought a one-way plane ticket, Boston to Brazil.
I have to go home. I have a lot of stuff to do there, so I gotta go.
Benicio's a 33-year-old illegal immigrant from Belo Horizonte, Brazil. For the past 5 years, she worked as a hairdresser in Alston, Massachusetts. She's not being forced out. She's eager to leave.
I'm going back, and I don't think I'll be able to come again. I don't want to come again. The style of life that I want to live... it's in Brazil, not here.
While the U.S. economy flounders, Brazil's is on a tear. It grew 5.4% in 2007. Its currency, the real, has doubled in value against the dollar in the past 5 years. In Brazil, Benicio can be close to her family, live without the threat of deportation, and run her own business. It's closing time at the beauty salon where Benicio works, and the cash register begins to total the day's sales. Benicio says she used the money she earned at the beauty salon to start a motorcycle repair shop back in her hometown.
I built my store, everything. I bought all the parts of motorcycle. Do you want to know how much that cost for me? $25,000, something like that.
Up to 10,000 Brazilian immigrants in Boston, many of them here illegally, are expected to follow Benicio home this year. Brazilian strongholds in New Jersey and South Florida are seeing a similar exodus. Many immigrants say they're leaving because they feel lonely and afraid, as local sentiment has turned against illegal immigrants. And for the first time in decades, these Brazilians have a viable alternative back home, a robust economy with plenty of jobs. Fausto da Rocha runs the Brazilian Immigration Center in Alston, Massachusetts. He says Brazilian businesses have popped up in towns across the state, places like Framingham, Marlboro, and Milford, not to mention the block outside his office.
For example, we're in Harvard Avenue. We have over here a beauty salon. We have a money transfer agency. We have a Brazilian bakery, a computer store, and the other Brazilian beauty salon.
Overall, Massachusetts has an estimated 1,000 Brazilian businesses with $250 million in annual sales. But economists say the reverse migration of Brazilians threatens this immigrant economy. Vera Diaz Freitas owns a jewelry store that caters to the Brazilian population.
We've been doing this for 16 years now. We have a niche market that's the Brazilian community in downtown Framingham.
Entrepreneurs like Diaz Freitas have helped revitalize the town center. And Diaz Freitas, an American citizen, has been a leading voice uniting old-timers with the new arrivals. But she says Framingham officials have turned hostile to the Brazilian community. Local police have started demanding documentation, and city officials have stopped returning calls.
We felt at home. It has changed. I feel violated.
I try to be a voice for my community. There is no one out there listening. The agenda is being fulfilled. That we are disappearing by the minute.
Sales at the jewelry store are down 75%. She may have to close.
Once shops like mine won't make it through, they will realize what they lost.
Experts say if the economy continues to slow, other immigrant groups may soon follow the Brazilian vanguard. In Framingham, Massachusetts, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, one that's not going to come as any surprise, but we thought we ought to point out that March car sales were down, and they were down a lot. General Motors reported a 19% decline this morning. Ford was off 14%. Losses hit foreign car makers for a change, too. Toyota saw its sales fall 10%. You can go ahead and blame the usual suspects. That's what the companies did. Low consumer confidence and the weak housing market. They did say they thought declines would level off later this year and pick up starting maybe in 2009. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 391 points, 3.2%. The NASDAQ gained 83 points, 3.6%. The S&P 500 jumped 47 points. That is 3.6% there as well. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, Ohio workers wave goodbye to three-day weekends.
It was actually kind of funny, though, when the person stated that it's the first Friday he'd been at work in 13 years, that I said, welcome back.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.